Welcome to today's deep dive. You know, it's funny. We are trained basically from birth to look both ways before we cross the street.
Right, yeah.
We get really, really good at identifying visible threats like speeding cars. We know how to avoid the dangers we can actually see.
Absolutely.
But the mission for today is to ask, well, what if the most dangerous risk to your entire career is the one that's completely invisible?
Oh, that is the big question.
Right. So we have this really raw, honest manifesto we're looking at today. It's called One Bad Quarter by Vlad Sealicu over at localghost.ai. And he basically argues that the comfortable corporate job you might be clinging to is, well, it's kind of a ticking time bomb.
Yeah, he really doesn't hold back.
Not at all. He says the risk hasn't disappeared just because you have a salary. It's just accumulating silently in the background. So today we are extracting some practical, hard-hitting advice for anyone out there who is, you know, maybe considering leaving the safety of a corporate role to start their own venture.
What's fascinating here is how this completely forces a reevaluation of what a safe career path even looks like today. I mean, we usually think of starting a company as this massive ultimate risk.
Right, like jumping out of an airplane.
Exactly. And staying put is the responsible, safe choice. But the author introduces this sharp dichotomy between invisible risk and visible risk. In a corporate job, your risk is just largely invisible to you.
Because you aren't in the room where the big decisions happen.
Yes. You don't see the macroeconomic pressures hitting the board of directors. You don't hear those quiet, closed-door conversations about restructuring. It's all hidden.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because he gives these really relatable examples that I think a lot of people listening will recognize. Like this guy, Alistair.
Oh, yeah, the Alistair story.
Yeah, so the author reaches out to Alistair with an opportunity for a small side project, and Alistair just completely turns it down. He says, I think the quote is he's going for senior next year, so he needs to put his head down, focus only on his day job, and not rock the boat.
And from a traditional standpoint, Alistair's being completely rational. I mean, he's protecting his primary income stream.
Right.
But the author points out that this calculation is just deeply flawed in the modern economy. Alistair is trading away the visible risk of trying something new for the invisible risk of putting literally all his eggs in a basket that somebody else controls.
He's banking on loyalty.
Exactly. He's assuming the system will reward his singular focus.
Yeah.
But the system, frankly, doesn't owe him anything.
And then there's the flip side of that, right? The story about Andy. So Andy actually loses his job in London. He's facing this really harsh market. And after just 3 months, he takes a new role that he openly admits he doesn't even like.
Yeah, he just settled.
He totally settled. And the psychology there is just wild to me. He took a mediocre job because the visible everyday anxiety of being unemployed felt so much worse than the invisible slow burn risk of just rotting in a job he hates.
Which brings us directly into Daniel Kahneman's behavioral economics.
Oh, right. From Thinking Fast and Slow.
Yes, exactly. The author references Kahneman because what Andy and Alistair are doing is textbook loss aversion. Evolutionarily, we are wired to feel the pain of a loss. Roughly twice as intensely as the joy of an equivalent gain.
Wow, twice as intensely.
Yeah. So if you have a decent salary, your brain literally treats the potential loss of that salary as a massive life-threatening danger.
So mechanically speaking, if you are a mid-career professional weighing the option of leaving, your brain is just screaming at you about the health insurance, the 401k match, your job title.
It completely overshadows any potential upside.
And it blinds you to the actual danger of staying put.
Precisely. Loss aversion isn't some logical decision you make. It's a biological posture. And the corporate system is perfectly aligned to exploit that psychological flaw. You get conditioned to just wait for better timing.
Right. There's never a good time.
Never. And you convince yourself you're just being prudent when really you're paralyzed by biology.
Which makes the core concept of this piece, the one bad quarter rule, make so much sense. Like your job, your promotion track, everything sits inside this massive structure you don't control.
You are always one bad quarter away from a sweeping decision made by someone three levels above you.
Based on a spreadsheet you'll never see.
And that right there is the definition of invisible risk. The ship is taking on water, but you don't get the warning. You just wake up to a vague calendar invite from HR.
God, the dreaded HR sink. So, okay, if I'm conceptualizing this correctly, is staying in a corporate job essentially like being a passenger on a luxury bus driven by someone else, but you're blindfolded?
I love that analogy.
I mean, think about it. The seats are leather, the AC is great, you get free snacks in the break room, it feels incredibly safe, right up until the driver randomly slams on the brakes or drives off a cliff.
And you had zero hands on the steering wheel.
Exactly. Whereas a founder is out there riding a bicycle, it is super wobbly, you feel every single pothole, you might scrape your knee, but you are the one holding the handlebars.
That bus and bicycle comparison is spot on, especially when we look at how failure actually works in both of those environments. Like, what happens when the blindfolded bus crashes versus when the bicycle hits a pothole?
The accountability piece, yes. Mm. The source has this crazy cautionary tale about a guy named Paul.
Oh, the restaurant guy.
Yeah. He built this voice AI ordering system for a group of 30 restaurants. They're all set to open on a Friday. And suddenly, the dev team goes completely dark. Just radio silence.
The author notes, it's that terrifying silence you only get when developers know they've shipped something catastrophically broken.
And the post-mortem on this failure is just, it's where corporate process totally breaks down. The core issue was a one-meter misalignment. But wait, sorry to cut in, but to a layperson, how does a physical distance of 1 meter break a software system?
No, it's a great question. So in systems like DriveThrust, the software uses spatial mapping or geofencing to know when a car is at the speaker post. If the physical blueprints of the restaurant lane are off by just 1 meter compared to the software's map, the microphone triggers too early or too late.
Oh, I see.
It starts assigning the voice order to the wrong car or picking up highway noise. That 1 meter discrepancy is load-bearing. It breaks the entire logical flow of the system.
That is nuts. The physical world and the software just didn't match. But the maddening part is that the original team who wrote that code is long gone. So the new team has to fix it without having been there when the concrete was literally poured.
And the worst part, the people who originally built it probably did everything right according to their corporate metrics.
Right. They were probably using agile methodology, sprints, tickets, daily stand-ups, they move their little digital tickets to done.
They succeeded at their specific metric.
But nobody actually owned the final integrated reality of the system.
This is exactly what happens when a company over-optimizes for process. Accountability gets distributed so thinly across the hierarchy that it just vanishes.
Everyone says, not my problem, I did my ticket.
Exactly. When failure hits, no one is holding the bag. The author actually connects this to Nassim Taleb's concept of skin in the game. The process diffused the risks so perfectly that no individual could be blamed, but that diffusion caused the disaster.
Contrast that with the story about the startup funeral meetup. This was in London, 2015, at the Google campus. Three founders actually got up on a stage in front of their peers and explained exactly why their companies died.
And they knew exactly why, because they made every single decision.
Right. There was no agile ticket to hide behind. The buck stopped with them.
But failing at something you built teaches you infinitely more than just being collateral damage in a corporate org chart. When you own the failure, you extract the real lessons.
I hear that, but I have to push back a little here. I mean, isn't it psychologically so much easier to hide behind the corporate process? Distributing the blame sounds pretty comforting compared to standing on a stage and admitting you burned your own savings. Are we underestimating the emotional toll of that?
It is undeniably heavier. And the author doesn't sugarcoat this at all. There is a real danger of over-optimism with entrepreneurship. Starting a company doesn't fix your problems. It just swaps your corporate problems for much more brutal founder problems.
And most of them fail.
Exactly.
Which brings us to the hard truths of this manifesto. If you are listening to this right now and plotting your escape from the corporate grind, you really need to hear this. The author makes a personal confession about his 12 years as a founder. He says there are long stretches that are just relentlessly hard.
There are days when being told what to do sounds like a dream.
Yes, because waking up to a blank slate and having to generate the strategy all by yourself is exhausting.
Because when something breaks, you are the final stop. The server crashes at 2 a.m. There's no IT desk. Client is furious. No middle management to hide behind. You are the CEO and the janitor.
He talks about finding your personal red lines, like your absolute limits financially, emotionally. How long can you go without a paycheck? How much rejection can you take? And his confession is that he didn't know his limits until he was standing right on top of them.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, entrepreneurship forces you to discover your risk tolerance in real time. We all think we are brave when we have a steady salary.
Right. It's easy to be brave with a safety net.
Exactly. You only find out who you really are when that net is gone. You cannot simulate having 4 weeks of runway left.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. That feels like a massive paradox. We constantly tell people to know their limits before starting a business, but the source says you literally can't know them until you cross them. So how do you prepare? Do you just jump and hope you build a parachute on the way down?
Well, you can't simulate the emotional fall, but you can change the mechanics of the jump, which is why he argues that right now is a uniquely pivotal time to make the leap. The psychological hurdles are terrifying, yes, but the technological reality has completely altered the risk equation.
The collapsing barriers. Let's talk about that. He argues the barrier to entry has just vanished. He tells this story about traveling recently. He had a laptop and a Starlink connection, and he built 5 fully functional websites for people he met.
From a boutique hotel to a dive school.
Yeah, and he was spinning these up in like 30 minutes. For the dive school, he had a working MVP, good enough to take bookings, finished before the client even finished his coffee.
And he's not just bragging about his typing speed. The point is that this velocity wasn't physically possible for one person a few years ago.
Right.
The gap between finding a problem and deploying software to fix it has shrunk from months of team effort to hours of solo work.
And the data backs this up. He cites Carta data tracking startup equity. Solo-founded startups went from 17% in 2017 to over 36% in early 2025.
That is a massive jump.
It tracks exactly with AI tooling going mainstream.
This raises an important question, though. With AI acting as your junior dev, your copywriter, your debugger, you don't need to raise a massive seed round just to test an idea. The cost of failing has plummeted because the cost of building has plummeted.
Which fundamentally changes the timing of your leap. You don't have to take a blind jump. He outlines a few different practical approaches using real people as case studies.
Right. There isn't just one way to be a founder anymore.
Take Oliver, for instance. Oliver is a senior engineer, topped out his career ladder, but realizes it's leaning against the wrong wall. Corporate work feels empty. So on the side, he teaches 10-year-olds how to program with Microdot Bits.
Which are these tiny, cheap, programmable computers for kids.
Yeah. Oliver hasn't quit his job, but he's building a parallel identity. He's finding his passion outside the corporate structure to see what actually brings him joy.
Then there's Dobre, who takes a different route. He wanted to start a dog rescue charity. Normally, that's thousands of dollars a month of agency work to build a database.
A huge hurdle.
But he heavily leveraged AI to build the entire content management system himself in just a few weeks. He used technology to bypass the old barriers.
And then Nina, who is super methodical, she stayed in her corporate job until she saved 6 full years of financial runway.
6 years is incredible.
It totally eliminates the financial panic. And she's not just jumping into her first idea. She is stress testing 3 different ideas using the lean startup method before she commits to one. Small, cheap experiments.
Looking at Oliver, Dobre, and Nina, they highlight this huge structural shift. The grand deal sold to tech workers is unraveling.
The idea that process equals maturity.
Right. We were told that a well-managed career inside a massive corporation was the safest destination. For decades, massive growth papered over the cracks in that promise.
But now growth has slowed, the layoffs are rolling in, and the gap is obvious.
We thought the corporation was holding the risk for us. We traded our upside for that security. But with the one bad quarter rule, it's clear they aren't holding the risk. They are just managing it, usually at our expense.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? Look at those case studies. Which camp are you in? Are you like Oliver, realizing you need to build a side passion? Or are you like Nina, methodically saving up a war chest so you can make a clean break?
The one thing they share is momentum. They aren't paralyzed by loss aversion. They know waiting for the perfect time is a trap. The invisible risk of stagnating is accumulating every single day.
To summarize all this, you aren't actually choosing between risk and safety. Safety is an illusion. You are choosing between an invisible risk that announces itself as a bad quarter calendar invite and a visible risk where you own every scraped knee, but also every single triumph.
The author closes the manifesto by quoting Brandon Sanderson's Knight's Radiant series, Journey Before Destination.
I love that.
The struggle, the late nights, the mistakes, that daily journey of building something is worth more than the final outcome.
It's all about agency. So we want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Think back to that blindfolded luxury bus ride. If your current company had a catastrophic bad quarter tomorrow and your role just completely vanished, What is the exact project you would wake up and start building the morning after? And if you already know what that project is, why on earth are you waiting for the bus to crash to start it?